Hi, my name is Nelima Chowdhury, but you can call me Nelly. And I'm here to share my journey through my mental health issues, and hopefully I can make a difference.
Okay, so good morning, Nelly. How are you? Yeah, actually, you're looking a bit sad, down.
Yeah, Steve, yeah. Good morning to you too. The last few days have not been that great.
What's been the problem?
Basically, one of my brother's best friends, childhood friends, passed away.
Oh dear.
Okay, and sorry?
Had he been ill?
He'd been suffering from mental health issues for a long time, for many years.
Oh right, so okay. He didn't just pass away?
No.
Oh dear.
I don't want to be the one to say how he passed away.
No, it's fine.
But he had been suffering from mental health issues for many years. And he was crying for help, but he clearly couldn't find it anywhere. And so he resorted to drugs and alcohol. Because we do that as our coping mechanisms. Me, I did the same thing. So I can relate to him. And it's unfortunate because we were very close. Obviously, he was my brother's best friend. He was always around the house. And he helped me in important parts of, you know, certain parts of my life. And I will always be very grateful to him. And this one's for you. This one's for you, Sultan. Where he liked to be known. This is how he went. He liked to be known as King Sultan. So on Facebook, he was King Sultan. He didn't realize the impact that he had on my life, that he was still a very special person. Friends that are boys.
Yeah.
Even though I was surrounded by males all my life.
Yeah.
So, and they were my friends. So, you know, my best friends were actually male. I could relate to the male gender more than I could to the females. I don't know. Maybe it was because I was always surrounded by males, or I looked up to the males in my family. For instance, my granddad, my dad, my uncle, and then my brother.
I'm really sorry to hear about that. But let's get back to you. And you were complicated at birth, you were telling us last week. So expand on that, please.
Okay, so you know, like when people meet me, they say that, oh my God, you're just weird, or like, you know, you're like, you're just so complicated. And I'm like, yeah, I know. And I always seem to take I've always taken the harder route than the easier route in life. In anything. I always seem to take the complicated one. But I now reflect and I see that even from my birth, I was quite complicated. And you ask why. Okay, so my mum told me that she went into labour, and at the time we used to live in a very affluent area called Gerrard's Cross. I don't know if do you know the area?
Yeah, I do. Steve?
Yep. So Gerrard's Cross, my dad owned a restaurant called the Prince of India. It was a very well-known established restaurant. It was his first successful restaurant. He did many before that, but this was his first successful restaurant. And it was so successful. And the customers that used to dine there were people like Cliff Richard, the Bee Gees, Cilla Black. So,
okay, you name dropper. But...
yeah.
But what happened when you were being born?
Okay, so my mum went into labour, and I was kind of halfway out, and then they ran out of oxygen in Gerrard's Cross. And then they had to take her in an ambulance to High Wycombe General Hospital, and that's where I fully kind of came out of her womb. So I'm like half from the affluent area of Gerrard's Cross and then half from the not-so-affluent area of High Wycombe. So now I realise why I can relate to the affluent people as well as the not so affluent people. So yeah, it is a better understanding of why I am the way I am.
Having been brought into this world, who would you say your best friend was as a child?
Oh, my best friend, my first love, is my dad. Was my dad, is my dad, and will always remain my dad. So in our religion, in Islam, they say that your mother comes first, your mother comes second, and your mother comes third. And then it's your father. I never understood that when I was young. Like, obviously, now I do as a mother myself. But when I was young, it was like, no, my dad comes first before anyone and everyone. And that's how I grew up. My dad was the coolest dad ever. You know, he was a very well-established businessman, as you may know. And he worked hard to give us the best life possible. Even back in the, you know, 70s, 80s, I'm saying, I don't want to... Well, you know my age anyway, so there's nothing to hide. But, you know, for me and my brother, my dad gave us the best life possible. And for a Bangladeshi British Muslim, it was just wow. We were going on holidays to Saint-Tropez, south of France, Disney World, America, Miami. We were staying, like, you know, on yachts, even back then. You know, I'm sure if you do research or whatever people do, that we must have been one of the first Bangladeshi Muslim families to experience that sort of lifestyle at that age. I was like, I was very young. Me and my brother were very young. So we kind of saw the top of the tops, the creme de la creme from a very young age.
But at that age, of course, it wouldn't have seemed different because you didn't know anything else.
We didn't know anything different. Yeah,
yeah, right.
But, you know, we did, because we still had family that were from not such a blessed background. And that is what, you know, taught us how to still remain humble.
Okay. Actually, I did have another question. It sort of relates to that. Well, sort of. Nelima Ahad Chowdhury?
Nelima Ahad Chowdhury.
What's that? So
Ahad means Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, God, is one.
Okay.
Ahad is my granddad's name, which I kept as my middle name. Obviously showing respect to him and appreciating the impact that he had on my life. And he had a very big impact. My granddad used to live with us, you know, so did my grandma when they used to be in England. So every morning without fail, I would see him with a newspaper. So be it the Gazette or the Sun or whatever it was back in those days. I can't remember the name. But he said to my dad, Anna, just make sure that every day a newspaper is here. So my dad would have to order, you know, those newspapers that every morning. And he would be sat there. And I could still picture him at breakfast. He'd sit there with his newspaper. And we'd be getting ready for school and be rushing to have breakfast. And then one day, all of a sudden, I must have been about 7. He just turned around to me and he said, you are the barrister of the family. You have got that voice. Make sure you become a barrister. He turned around and said to my dad, Anna, you make sure that you make your daughter a barrister. Until this day, now I can reflect and I can see, do you know what? He was right. I have a very strong voice. I have, you know, from what people have told me, I have, some people say it's magical. Some people say it's infectious. Some people say that they could listen to me for hours. I hope that this is the case, hence this podcast, you know. But yeah, I think that's a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I was born with a very powerful voice. And unfortunately, due to life, I kind of felt that I lost my voice for a while.
Okay. You don't take to silences very well, do you?
I absolutely detest silence. Hence, art was never my subject.
You couldn't sit there and concentrate?
No, I hate silence. You know, my children, they say, Mum, can you just sit still? Can you just be silent for a while? I was like, no, I can't. I'm always agitated. I have to be doing things because I feel that when I'm in silence, I'm lost with my thoughts and it just consumes me and all this badness comes into my head and I just want goodness. I want to be the happy-go-lucky person. I don't want to think about sadness. You know, I relate silence to sadness.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I don't know. I sort of, I talk to my dog. I guess that's probably breaking the silence as well.
But. Well, I was thinking of actually having a dog, but... In our religion, like, we're not supposed to have dogs apart from they should be as guard dogs.
Right, okay.
That's what we believe in. You can have cats. I did think about having a cat.
Okay.
But my children wouldn't let me. So maybe one day when they leave home.
All right, fine. So you just touched there on the fact you didn't particularly like art. So that was probably not your best subject at school then. So what did you do at school?
Ashfold was my paradise.
Okay.
Okay. Like, I loved it. I loved every single second of it. That was just, that's where I thrived. That's where I could be me. You know, I was setting myself challenges every day. Like, I was looking around, I was observing, I was learning from everyone, all my teachers. They taught me etiquette. They taught me how to speak well. They taught me how to present myself well. They taught me so much about religion, about everything, just general, you know, the basic principles of being a good human. I was taught at Ashfold by very good humans, very good humans. And I salute all of them. And I want all of my teachers to know how very much I appreciate them for the impact that they've had on my life and for making me who I am today.
Okay, so were you a sporty person?
I was a little bit of everything, but I made sure that I was number one in everything. So be it hockey, be it netball, be it tennis, be it, you know, I wanted to do football, but my parents said, no, football isn't for you. And at that time, it wasn't a girl's sport. Now I'm so proud of all the, you know, footballers, the lady footballers, they are doing us proud. And I wish someone was there for me back then, for me to be able to play football. But unfortunately, it wasn't I can't be good at everything, can I?
Well, no, I mean, it was a different time.
Yeah.
And
I excelled in sports. I excelled in academics. I was the head chorister. I did loads of drama productions. So I was a very good actress as well, I think, if I say so myself, because I got the lead roles in all the plays, to the extent where I played the first Asian Tallulah in Bugsy Malone. And I remember it. And I was just... I was proud, you know.
Doesn't she get a cream pie in her face?
Yeah. Well, we kind of missed that bit out. I just loved the whole, I just loved drama. I actually loved drama. I loved acting. But unfortunately, like, for the Asian community culture, it just wasn't something that a girl could go into at that time. Now, however, times have changed, you know. Anyway, all these successes led me to eventually become the head girl of Ashfold School. Wow. And the first Asian head girl of Ashfold School. And I'm proud that my name is still on that cup.
Excellent. Well done. So, but Ashfold's not for like hundreds of years. That sort of stops at a certain age?
Yes, it does. So, yeah, I did my 11 plus and I failed by a couple of marks. This was my first failure after many years of successes. So this was already a sign that now you need to learn about failure. So after that, my dad managed to get me in. He appealed and he got me into the grammar school, the high school. So I went to Aylesbury High School after that. The transition from Ashfold to Aylesbury High School was absolutely horrible, horrible. When I left Ashfold, I felt like I was leaving paradise and entering hell.
Why is that?
That's just how I felt. I felt like I was starting at the bottom, especially starting as a failure.
So is that actually this big fish syndrome where in Ashfold, because it's a relatively smaller school, there's less people there.
Yes, it is. We had...
And you were a big fish in that pond.
Yes.
And then you went from that pond into the big lake of an Aylesbury Central School. Was that the fact that you weren't the big fish well, anymore? Because there were already big fish 6 years above
yes,
you.
Yes, yes,
and they were all floating around and...
Maybe, but, you know, from my perspective was that I don't remember hardly anything about Aylesbury High School, but I remember every single day that I spent at Ashfold. You know, I was so blessed to have such good teachers, such good teachers. For instance, my headmaster, he used to come and watch me in the hockey matches. He loved hockey. So he's like, Nelly Chowdhury, I want to come and see what you're made of. Like, obviously my sports teacher said, yeah, this girl, she's something, come and watch her. And I would be proud. He'd just come and stand on the line and he'd be watching me. You know, my parents never watched me play a single game, but my head teacher came and actually watched me play hockey. And he motivated me to go all the way. He goes, don't stop playing. You're too good. You're too good. And to the point that he made, I was sports captain. I was sports captain. And then he was the one to present me with Head Girl Cup. And he was proud of me. He said, you are going to go places. You are going to go places.
And you did.
And yeah, alhamdulillah.
Yeah. Alhamdulillah. I remember when I first met you in Haddenham, you didn't have this big sign over your head that said, I'm a nutter. But obviously something at some point went wrong and it gave you these mental issues. So what was that?
Okay, this topic is quite a sensitive topic. And I just want to reiterate, I am not going to mention any names and I don't wish to cause any hostility or any backlash or aggressiveness, nothing. I don't want any response from anyone. I just need to share this and help people out there that may be experiencing what I experienced as a child, but I shouldn't have experienced. So I experienced child abuse, child grooming at a very young age. And I wasn't the only one. My cousins, they know who they are. And hopefully they'll be proud of me for speaking up about this topic, which is just brushed underneath the carpet in our Asian community. And still, till this day, I think it is still happening. And there are girls out there that are unable to share what's happening with them and get help. So I want to be that voice to help other young girls so that they don't have to go through what I went through and my cousins went through. We knew it was wrong. We knew how wrong it was, how painful it was. But we had no one to turn to. There was no one to help us. We couldn't tell our parents. You know, what would they think of us? We felt shameful that we allowed our so-called uncles to do this to us. They abused us on a regular basis. They groomed us on a regular basis. And we couldn't share with anyone apart from each other. Some of my cousins were, you know, they turned around and they said to me, this is wrong. This needs to stop. But we still didn't do anything about it. And I was thinking, as my cousins were, that, oh, this must be, you know, this must be how it is, how it's supposed to be. This must be like what, first love or whatever, you know, the grooming part anyway. Now, when I reflect upon it, they were like married men. They had children of their own. And they were doing what they were doing to us. They knew it was wrong. They shouldn't have done what they did to us.
I'm really sorry to hear about that. We talked about school and we talked about Asheville being such a brilliant place and how you didn't really enjoy Aylesbury High. You went to uni and we'll talk about that again in the future because I think that's a bit more complex. And then you came back to Haddenham. You used to visit the restaurant in Haddenham where I eventually met you.
Yeah.
So tell me about that time.
My dad used to have a restaurant in Tame as well, but I preferred Haddenham for some reason. So I like the food from there. I like going there. I just like the atmosphere in Haddenham. So yeah, from a very young age, since they opened Haddenham, I preferred to go to Haddenham than Tame.
So you were just going as a guest?
I would just drive. You know, once I learned how to drive, I'd just drive there and just say, oh, I'm bringing some friends. Can you get a table of four ready? And they'd get it ready. And yeah, so I'd socialize. I would just tell them and they'd know, okay, it's the boss's daughter. She's coming. Make sure that the table's ready. Yeah.
And you didn't have to pay.
And I didn't have to pay. Yeah, at the end of it. And nor did my friends. So yeah.
Okay. So tell me a bit more about that time then. Because I mean, that's, as I say, that's so where I met you.
So during that time, I got close to the staff there because obviously we did a lot of talking. Yeah. And there was a few of them that, you know, that I was like, okay, yeah. They became my friends. Yeah, so it started off as just friendship, a couple of them. And then from my dad, he used to always, he'd always say that there was this young manager that was running the restaurant at the time. He would say that, you know, this guy's really good. He's got a lot of drive. He's going to do well in life. He's going to succeed in life. So I was like, oh, so he thinks that this guy's good. So from, you know, as my dad's daughter, I was like, okay, I haven't met anyone like my father, but my sort of not aspiration, but, you know, like my intention was to find a guy similar to my father to marry. And I searched, went to university, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I just never did find anyone that could go anywhere near my dad. So it was like, okay, Nelly, maybe you're not going to get married because maybe that person doesn't exist. To the point where even my dad, he used to say to our relatives, like, my daughter's never going to get married. You know, like, she's always going to stay at home with me. I will always keep her at home. And they would joke and they'd go, you know, like my uncles would joke with him saying, Anna, you can't keep your daughter at home for the rest of her life. That's just absurd. And it was kind of a joke, but he was kind of being serious as well. He probably thought that there's no one good enough for me either.
But so I'm guessing that Nelly didn't feel that way.
No, I was quite drawn to this manager who was who was younger than me. He drove a nice car at that age. It was a Lexus. And yeah, he just instantly, there was something about him that just got my attention, which led me to approach him.
To approach him or to
pounce on him?
Yeah, okay.
Bengal tigress pounces. Yeah. Yeah, you could call it pounce because he weren't having none of it. He was like, do you know what you're doing? Do you know what you're saying? You are Anna Chowdhury's daughter. There is no way I'm going to have a relationship with you. And I was like, really? And that was a challenge. That was a challenge for me. So I didn't see it as anything else. I was like, this guy is challenging me, saying that he's not going to fall in love with me. Watch what I do. Watch what I do to you. Yeah, it was like a challenge to me. So I just wanted to prove a point, and it kind of ended up in marriage.
That's a bit excessive, really, isn't it?
That's the way I am, though. That's probably my bipolar, yeah? The impulsive, excessive side.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, stop there.
Okay, yeah.
Just back up a little bit.
Yeah.
What do you mean you didn't just get married? What happened? I mean,
I made him fall in love with me first.
But you were living at home.
Yeah. I was living at home, and then I wanted to test his love by saying, can you get me out of here? I just wanted to leave home. I was going through my own personal issues, depression, you know, just life in general. Like, I'd finished university. I didn't know what I was doing with my life. I just needed to get out for a while. Maybe if I'd taken a year out and traveled the world, I would have been all right. But I decided to take this option. Yeah, I basically said to him, if you really love me for who I am, you'll come and pick me up. So I had like bin bags with all my clothes and everything. I was ready. Like, I was just waiting outside the gates. My parents were asleep. My brother, my sister-in-law at the time, they were all sleeping. They didn't have a clue that I'd left them a long love letter. It wasn't really a love letter, it was a really harsh letter, just saying that I've had enough, I'm going, I don't want no money, I don't want anything, I don't like this life, I'm leaving you guys. Good luck without me, basically. And that's how I left. You know, I knew like a couple of hours later they're going to read that letter and then they're going to have the police on the search for me, et cetera, et cetera. I knew exactly what was going on. And so I was fully sane. Like, they thought that I must have gone mad or I had some sort of black magic done to me, but it was nothing like that. It was nothing. I knew what I was doing. So I take full responsibility for that. Nothing was their fault. Nothing was his fault. I just told him, if you really love me, you're going to pick me up at 2 o'clock in the morning outside. Yeah. So I was sat there with bin bags. Can you imagine me? Yeah, you can. Yeah. sat there with bin bags full of my clothes, certain clothes that I couldn't, you know. And one thing that I took with me when I left the house was my Quran. And that stayed with me throughout my journey. Until this day, I have that Quran. And that was given to me by my mum's dad, my nana. And I still have that. So yeah, that was like my comfort. That was like, you know, well, it's a Quran. It's like, you know, you guys call it Bible. I held it on my chest, and he came and picked me up, and he saw me with the Quran, and I was like, he's just looking, and I was like, yeah, this is my strength. Anyway, so I was shocked that he turns up, and I was like, oh, okay, so you're going to go on this ride with me. You agree to go on this ride with me. You know it's going to be bumpy. You know there are going to be grave consequences of the step that you're taking. He goes, listen, be quiet, get in the car. I'm here. I love you. I don't care about anything else. I said, okay then. So we got in the car. We had to go to the police station and make a statement because we knew what was going to happen in a couple of hours. There's going to be police looking for us and, you know, all kinds of problems, whatever. Anyway, we made the statement. I went to the police station. I made a statement. He signed it. I signed it saying that I willfully left my house. No one forced me. It was all my decision. And then we went along our journey. We ended up going to France for a bit. America for a bit, and then we came back to England. And it wasn't until I was, you know, eight months pregnant where I felt the real need to contact my family again. In between, there was like bits of contacts here and there, but that's when I felt like now I'm missing home. I'm missing my mom and dad. I'm missing my brothers. I want to go back home. So I thought, how do I get in touch with them again? Because I didn't have any phone. I didn't have any access. Luckily, they must have been feeling the same. So they sent one of my cousins with a little mobile phone to hand to me so that I could use. Anyway, he entered the house and he just secretly handed me over this phone. He just said, there's one number on there. You call that number or you message that number. And then he left. That number was my elder brother's number. So I messaged him and I just said, I really miss you. And he said, okay. And he said, well, do you want to meet up? And I said, yeah, I'd love that. So we met up. I left the house. We met up. And basically, you know, I just wanted to get out of my husband's house. Like, I think his purpose in my life was fulfilled. When I left his house, it was just like, okay, this is the ending of this. But I had this child in me. I was eight months pregnant. I didn't know what I was going to do with that. I didn't know what I was going to do about that. Anyway, my brother picked me up and he said, right, let's get away from here. Let's go to Bangladesh. So I said, okay, then I will follow your lead. You know, I believe you. I know that you're going to do the best for me. I'm not in the right frame of mind, very emotional, hormonal, et cetera, et cetera. Let's go. Let's get away from here. If I stay in England, we're going to have police getting involved, et cetera, et cetera. Right now, I don't know what I want to do with my life. So anyway, alhamdulillah, I was blessed. My brother took the lead and he told my parents, like, yeah, I'm going to take her to Bangladesh. She needs a break. So anyway, he took me to Bangladesh and for a break. And unfortunately, on the plane journey, my health deteriorated. And when I landed, I had to have an induced labor, which led to a stillborn baby being born.
So, you're now in Dhaka.
Yep.
Good time?
Very good time. Very good time. Obviously, I was going through emotions, you know, after going through what I went through. And I think it was my dad that said, you can't live like this. You have to get your life back on track. What about getting a job here in Dhaka? And I was like, where do I begin? Where do I start? You know, I'm from England. I've come to Dhaka. What do I do? Anyway, because I had to go to the High Commission to do this statement with the consular section, you know, to for this divorce from my husband. I really like the environment there. So I said to my dad, "Dad, is there any way that I could get a job in the High Commission?" And he goes, "Of course there is. You know, we've got some relatives that already work there. Maybe they'll be able to help." So my aunts that used to work there, one of them is still there in the pensions department, and she's been there for years. So she and her sister said, "Yeah, there's interviews coming up. If you want to come and attend, see how it goes." So I thought, yes, my chance to get through the door. Let's go and attend this interview.
Okay, so let's leave it there because we'll come back next week and we'll talk about your time in Dhaka. How's that? Nelma, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much.